All right. Good evening. My name's Toby, and I'm an alcoholic. You know, this is going to be an interesting night. I don't know if you've either been here for the last four or five meetings, except for last week, but there's at least two or three common elements. One, they were all alcoholics. Two, they had a strong cross addiction, most likely. And three, the man that's speaking tonight, his name came up in every speaker's story. I'm excited to hear it. He sounds like he's been a very strong influence in the recovery of many men and women, I would assume. And with that, Mr. H.
What's up, everybody? My name is Matt. I'm an alcoholic. I don't think I've ever helped any woman's recovery before, except my wife. Maybe. Anyway. I was born in 1965, got sober on 1/25/97, almost 6,000 days. By God's grace, my hard work, and a lot of friends and a great sponsor. I'm emotional tonight. I'm overwhelmed by my friends being here. I've spoken a bunch of times before. I always get a little bit jittery, but tonight seems to be a little bit extra. I like that. It reminds me I'm still alive. And some of the events that have taken place over these last few days affect me a lot, and it's made me reflect, and it's also made me really grateful, because I give a shit today. You know, I care about things big and small, you know, and my friends and my family and things that happen in the world. And before, I couldn't give a flying you know what about anything except my next hit or drink. It's all I cared about. I was raised in New Jersey, upper middle class family, the youngest of three. My dad worked me hard. There was nothing for free. And it was rough. It was rough. I never felt right. You know, I always had this void. I always felt like I had to prove something. You know, my brother was the golden child. You know, number one in every class he ever took all the way through. And he was 6 years my elder, and I had to follow that, and I could not compare. And I grew up with a judo family. My best friend, that's still one of my closest friends now. We spent our entire childhood together since 4 years old, and it's kind of more a part of his family than my own. And although I had all this training and we did crazy stuff, there was always somebody tougher than me. There was always somebody smarter than me. There was always somebody that was more skilled at playing a certain sport than me. There was always a feeling like I wasn't good enough. And what transpired from that was like this reaction that my ego got so blown out of proportion and so full of myself, even though really inside I felt like I was less than. And this made me do all sorts of nutty things at a young age. A lot of fights, a lot of trouble. It took me to some places without a drink that were telltale signs of where I was headed. And there were three summers that when I was 9, 10, and 11 that I worked on a hay and horse farm in upstate New York. And after like a 12-hour day of baling hay, the owner of the farm turned around from the front of the tractor and he threw us all a beer. And we all drank it. And although I didn't get completely obliterated while I was away at that age, I was waking up in the morning and having some beer right off the bat, but not getting like out of control. And through high school, everything was pretty much okay. A lot of studying, a lot of sports. But senior year, when the license came, and cutting school started happening a lot, and going to Jones Beach and in New York, and getting into significant amounts of trouble there, and drinking to excess, but not often. I went to undergraduate school, and at the end of my first year, my roommate handed me a pipe. A marijuana. I was scared. And I took that hit, and that was it. I felt like what I had been looking for all the way along. Like that feeling of being a part of, like I was okay. Like I fit in, like, you know, girls, just everything just seemed to line up perfect, right off the bat, like that. And I spent the next 5 years stoned and drunk 24/7. And I studied a lot. And in psych class, they taught me about something called state-dependent learning, that if you're gonna get screwed up, you know, when you're going to study, you better take the test screwed up. So I basically just stayed messed up the entire time. And I thought I had scientific evidence to help me, you know. College was a really good experience. I made some teams to play in college, and after I made the team and then I realized how much work it was going to be to actually stay on the team, I decided, nah. And I played rugby. Instead of joining a fraternity, me and 18 other guys started our own. And the combination of fraternity life with rugby, alcohol, my life became connected to the keg. And I accomplished some really good things, mostly around that fraternity thing. But man, I was off the chain. No consequences yet. But boy, my life started to become pretty darn unmanageable. Senior year in college, I had my first snort of cocaine, and didn't go off the chain with it right off the bat. Went to graduate school. For the first 2 years of graduate school, I drank and smoked weed every single day, all day, just like I was in college. Studied my ass off. Like, all I did was study. But I was messed up. But then the cocaine started to come in again. And I became a disgusting human. I mean, I lived in... When I think back of like the months of garbage that I would let pile up in my apartment and not take it out, and the type of food and what I was looking like, and it was disgusting. And it's an important part of my story looking back to how brutal it got. And I worked through graduate school, even with all the alcohol and other chemicals. I kept working hard, and I did pretty well. I remember taking my first 2 years, there's a national board on all the basic sciences, and every different profession has the same national board. And I was up 2 days and two nights on cocaine beforehand, and then I went to take the test. And I don't know how I passed it, but I remember thinking there's something wrong. Like, how could I have done this? Like, there was like a little bit of light in my brain that I all of a sudden realized that, and maybe I'm not doing so well. I graduated school. I came down to Florida. I didn't know Alon, so I didn't know how to get any cocaine in Florida. So I just continued with the marijuana and the alcohol. And then I met this guy that was a cocaine dealer, and things got twisted up really bad. And he taught me how to start cooking it and smoking it. And at that point, I had already started my own business, and my parents were helping me a lot, enabling the hell out of me. And I was spiraling down out of control and still living in a disgusting environment, and yet keeping up with this sort of, you know, like Matt's doing okay, the professional, somehow I was keeping up that a little bit. But then, you know, every minute of every waking moment, everything that I could think about was either how I was going to buy the time and the stuff that I want in order for me to hide myself away and get completely obliterated. And I see now how little I felt of myself, and how truly low my self-esteem was to put myself in this position, going as hard as I was going and blowing everything important off in life. No matter how wonderful it was, I wanted to be locked down in my apartment, leave me alone. All I wanted to do. And these behaviors led to things like, you know, I'm driving a fast car without brakes, with tires showing metal, and just thinking, you know, I'll get a flat tire and I'll get a new one. But I used to leave at lunch to go home and take a power nap because I was up all night night before, so I would drive like 120 miles an hour from my office to my apartment to crash for 2 hours. And I blew a tire. And this is what happened. I blew a tire, and I flipped my car going well over 100 miles an hour. I didn't have my seatbelt on. And I was half in and half out of my car, on the roof of my car, sliding I don't know how many hundreds of feet. But it was a lot. And I was in a coma for 6 days. And I fractured like 80 bones in my body. And my brain was like showing. And one more hit in my head and I wouldn't be here. And I'll never forget laying in that hospital bed on day 7. And my family's starting to come in, and everybody's got this serious look on their face. And I'm thinking, like, wow, everybody's coming to see me. My uncle's walking in. And then my best friend from college comes in. He's got this look on his face. And I knew the jig was up. You know, my blood work came back with, like, 9 different things in it, whatever it was. And I gave up. Fake. And I went to treatment after I got out of the hospital. And nobody would come near me. I was oozing. And I felt so ashamed that I can't believe that I'm in a drug treatment center. And I didn't do anything. I barely complied. And I stayed there for 4.5 months. And when one thing didn't go my way, I left. And I went, it wasn't an hour that I was drinking and doing everything else. My parents and my brother, they put a warrant out for my arrest because I had a few charges. And I got arrested, and I went to jail for the first time, and I didn't do well. I got into a really big fight. Like, the first 5 minutes I was there, somebody thought that I was looking at him and listening to their conversation, and he slammed my head up against the bars, and I went ballistic. And from there, it just went really bad, and I remember somehow they transferred me over to this Drug Abuse Foundation. There's a drug farm, the Palm Beach County Drug Farm. It's in some sugarcane country. I don't even remember what town it was. And I remember sitting there and holding and looking out the window, and I yelled at the sergeant to please let me go back to jail. Because these guys looked so scary, I thought that I was going to get raped and I'm in big trouble. And, you know, I stayed there for a pretty long time, and I got out, and the same thing kept happening. You know, I kept coming out of treatment, you know, and I'm thinking that really I'm just a cokehead and I'm a pillhead, but I never drank that much alcohol, so I'm just going to go drink a few, and I'll be okay. And each time I did that, it wouldn't be but an hour or a day, and I'm back doing everything else, top to bottom, off the chain, locked down, in a hotel room. And one time with a boatload of money, and I was in there for 35 days, and I lost, I don't know, 60, 70 pounds. And my crack dealer put me up in his mom's cockroach-infested trailer. And one night I found some of her Darvocet, and I took whatever in the bottle that was left, because Darvocet's nothing. That's what I'm thinking. Oh, and by the way, just to lighten it up for a second, Bear wanted me to say how important he was to my recovery. And he is. So shout out to Bear, by the way.
Got two left.
Yeah, I got to do it 3 times. And I remember waking up the next day, you know, really kind of thinking, why did I awaken? And this batshit crazy grandmother of this crack dealer asked me to go in the backyard and dig out this big boulder out of her backyard, put it in a shopping cart, and push it up her street and dump it. And I remember saying to myself, after all the bottoms that I've been through and everything that I've done, I remember saying, Matt, what has happened to you? It's kind of humorous, but it's sad. And I walked from that point, Tampa Street and something, all the way up to Florida and Fletcher, to go back to Healthcare Connection, and I sat down with Tom Edwards, and they turned me away. And, you know, nobody would help me. No parent, no family member, no cousin, no friend, no... I tried everybody, man. I burned every bridge, and everybody was gone. And there was one guy, and his name was Jack. And I called him. He said that he came back from Egypt early because he thought that there was something wrong. and he was a dentist in the state of Florida, and his license was in a little bit of jeopardy, and everybody told him, don't help Matt. He is a danger. Don't help Matt. And the board of dentistry actually told Jack that if you help this guy, it shows your poor judgment, and therefore we are not going to let you go back to work if you help Matt. He said, I love Matt. And he came and he got me. And for 9 nights, he put me up. Back then, to get into the Salvation Army, you had to drop clean. And I had only gone on like a 6 or 7 day run before that point. So it took 9 nights. And he took me to the Army every single morning, drop urine. And I was a mess. I was completely suicidal. Going to that place was like a death sentence to me. I would have done anything else. Before I got there, I was calling the Peace Corps. I was calling the military. I was calling. Nobody would effing let me in. Nobody. And so I went. And the first 30 days at the Salvation Army was not a pretty sight. I wanted to kill myself, kill somebody else, kill anyone that was in charge, or leave and just get messed up and die. I couldn't take myself. I couldn't look in the mirror. I couldn't talk to anybody. Bear number two, you can relate to that. It was the worst experience those first 30 days I've ever had in my entire life, compared to jail and hospitals and all the other institutions and everything. Being in that place was so devastating to me, such a brand of failure, an indigent treatment center. And on like the 35th day, and Andy in the bed next to mine and always saying, whatever I'm thinking ain't gonna happen. And I despised what he was always telling me. I opened up this book out of the blue, The Road Less Traveled by Scott Peck. And the first, thank God, it was the first line of the first paragraph, because I wouldn't have gotten any further than that. It said that life is often painful, and the quicker I accept that, the less painful it'll become. And like a light bulb went off. And that next day, the program director told my sponsor, he's still my sponsor now, to step up to me and tell me that he was going to be my sponsor. But he wouldn't look at me, and he wouldn't shake my hand. He wouldn't listen to me. All he did was give me something to read. The doctor's opinion. Over and over and over and over and over again. And I would write books because he treated me so bad. You know, he treated me with such disrespect, like I deserved respect, you know. You know, that was like another wacko thing that happened to me, that, you know, I'm in the street, I'm sleeping on dirt roads, I'm eating out of dumpsters, I'm in and out of jails, I'm abusing my family, I'm hurting everybody that knows me. And then I get there, and somebody's trying to help me, and you don't know who I am. How dare you treat me that way? It's crazy. It's absolutely nuts. But he pissed me off so bad. He made me so angry that I wanted to do something to spite him, to show him. And he would tear up my assignments and throw them out his window. He would drop me off. He dropped me off at the Salvation Army after I got off restriction after a meeting. And he would still never look at me. This is months, not eye to eye, and not shake my hand. And he'd pull up to the front doors, and I'd like really try to show him that I was trying to start to get serious, even though I was still faking it. And he said, "Get the fuck out of my truck." And I'm cursing a lot, but it's quote unquote, sorry for disrespecting the church. If anybody takes offense, too bad. But I am sorry. I am kind of sorry. In seriousness, that I hope I'm not, you know, offending anybody. And so he spurred me on. He lit a fire under me like I had never felt before. And when they talk about fake it until you make it, that's what I was doing then. But I was suiting up and showing up, and I was doing everything that he told me to do and everything the Salvation Army told me to do, even though I didn't think I could stay sober. I didn't want to be there. My life was a complete wreck. But I kept plugging away. But with each assignment, I started to feel a little bit better. Like for the first time, that relief that I got from that first hit of weed, like I started feeling like I have a little bit of relief, like I'm kind of okay. Why? What is going on? So I wanted more of that, and I just kept going after it really hard. And I remember at the 4-month mark or so, I got there February 2nd or 3rd, and like tax stuff started happening. You know, when we get food stamps at the Salvation Army, all of a sudden, you know, the government knows where I am. And I didn't do my 95 or 96 taxes, but from 94, I had a credit, like a $7,000 credit. I owed them tens and tens of thousands of dollars. And they sent me a letter. "What would you like us to do with this money?" And one of the biggest stepping stones was me turning that letter over to the program director and asking for his help to please help me write a letter to the IRS to apply this to whatever I owe from those other 2 years, which was a lot. Instead of getting that money, because normally what I would do, oh my God, you give me some money like that, I'm gone. And that was a big stepping point for me. And I think I started to believe in myself, like maybe I was serious for the first time. Because if I didn't run, maybe something's a little bit different. And I kept plugging away. Man, we went to a lot of meetings. I had like 5 or 6 guys. We all watched each other's backs. And a lot of you guys know this part of the story. And, you know, a whole bunch of us are still sober today, which is a miracle. And everything was program and fellowship. Everything. They told me I'd probably never go back to work. And I remember it was the day before my 1-year anniversary, and I was still at the Army, and they told me that it looks like my license to do what I know how to do is going to be revoked for life. And I remember this feeling coming over me of complete despair. And I rode my bike back from Healthcare Connection back to the Army, crying, snotting. I had $700 in my locker that I had saved up as a truck helper for 7 months. It was 5 months in the kitchen, 7 months as a truck helper. And I was going. I was gone. The decision, it wasn't even a decision. And I rode my bike back, and all I could think about was taking that $700 and going to do what I know how to do best. It was a Saturday morning around noon, and I rolled up on the Salvation Army, and that program director that was my sponsor's best friend, who's never there on Saturday, was like standing at the front door, like waiting for me. And he obviously saw And he pulled me into his office, and I stayed for like 3 hours. And he made me speak at our home group. The meeting place in Lutz used to be my home group. It's 3333 now. And with the help of my friends and the people, my mentors, you know, God put these people in the right spot at the right time. Because I was gone. But I didn't. And that was the biggest spiritual awakening that I've yet to have. That woke me up to God's power. That even though I made the decision, that I still didn't. And what was explained to me was that all the work that I had done, everything that I had done for that first year, all came to that pinpoint, came to that bearing point, right there and then, for an intervention from a power greater than me. And I left the Salvation Army 2 days after that and directly into a halfway house. And all I did at the halfway house was I got a real job. I took the bus for about a year. But everything else stayed the same. My home group, my support, my sponsor, the guys that were picking me up at the Salvation Army were still picking me up at the halfway house. I was making minimum wage and my head was down on a different pillow. But everything else was the same. So I kept cruising. You know, Andy and I, we like decided that we both weren't going to be able to go back to our profession. So let's go to Voc Rehab and let's become a chef. And I was totally good, happy, psyched to do that. And I was, that was another big turning point for me, that I wasn't defining myself as my family or what I do or the type of ball I play, or I wasn't defining myself that way anymore. I was defining myself as a recovering drunk. And really all I wanted to do was stay sober and not die anymore. I didn't want to live that way anymore. And so for that year of taking the bus, and I worked at Loomis Fargo and I separated coins. And my fingers still kind of hurt from that. But I always remember, you know, you walk through and there's the big plate, thick glass with all the cash behind there. And that was really hard to see every day. The change was no problem, but the cash. But man, that was a humbling and an important part of my early recovery, that second year of no car, no license, no profession, no nada, just recovery. And I went at it just as hard then as I did when I was in treatment. And at that 2 year mark, all of a sudden, I'm sitting at Healthcare Connection and I got tapped on the shoulder. So how's work? And there's this guy that's like really important in the licensing bureaus of the state of Florida and all that. And I'm like, you know, it's going okay. My fingers really hurt from all the coins that I'm pushing around. He's like, no. I mean, your work. And he lifted all the stuff after 2 years of sobriety, of all the revocation and the emergency suspensions and all the danger to myself and others and all that stuff that's in my record and still is, because it's so true. And I got a chance to go back to do what I knew how to do, and that was pretty cool. And I started off then part-time, so I still do it part-time now, as most of you guys know. I'm not ashamed of that. My life has morphed. It's completely, like, I've experienced living that disgusting life of shitting on everybody, and now living a life surrounded by people that I love me, and the miracles abound. And I, my daughter, first I have to get back to, after starting back to work, I had met Kerry through through a friend, and I could tell she kind of liked me, and she could tell I kind of liked her, so I worked this really honest program, and so I called her up and I gave her a big dose of honesty, and I don't want to get too graphic. No graphic, but I basically told her everything I wanted to do, and you know, the miracle of sticking with it and staying in the groove and having all this support and a sponsor and a home group and going back to the Salvation Army as much as I was, it allowed me to start to do some regular life stuff that I should have been able to know how to do the whole time along but didn't know how. And Kerry and I have stayed together ever since, and we did everything ass backwards. We got pregnant, and then we moved in, and then we bought a house, and then we got married. Leave it to the alcoholic, right? And you know, all the way along, no matter what happened in my life, good, bad, Zoe, who's such an unbelievable light in my life, you know, I kept plugging away, you know. I the guys that know me, I just don't stop. It's not that I'm afraid to stop. Well, kind of a little. But mostly, it's because of what the outcomes are. Because it feels good. It might be helping others, but mostly, man, my insides, it gives me hope, and it leads me to believe that one day at a time for the rest of my life, as long as I keep doing this stuff, I can take my last breath a sober one. And so through all these years, I'm going to skip back just for a second so nobody freak out. I spent 2.5 years in a halfway house. That's a little too long, maybe. But maybe not. Because it worked for me. And I moved in with another recovering guy from the halfway house. We stayed in the same house for 4 years. And then everything with Zoe happened, and then Kerry and I were living together, and no matter what changes happened, and no matter what sicknesses in my family and personal stuff and good things and bad and different groups putting me in positions of responsibility, which I still kind of retract from, like I still have that self-esteem thing sometimes, like don't you know the pig that I am? Like, you can't, like, give me all this stuff. Why are you trusting me with all this? You shouldn't really do this. But these things keep happening, and maybe that lack of, the little bit of lack of self that I still have is a way of kind of God protecting me from my brain going zappo. Because all the mentors in my life, all the therapists, all the guys that had tens of years that helped me, that saved me, they're all gone, except my sponsor. Every single one have relapsed and retrashed their lives or are dead. And it reminds me how to trust God. But the way I get my higher power is through you guys, you know, our group, my friends, that's... Because I don't get burning bush, you know? I don't get... My meditation is a joke. I can't shut my brain down for long enough to listen to anything, really. I have trouble with that. But man, the people that love me now, I listen. And the miracles of Zoe and Carrie and my nephews and nieces who my brother wrote my eulogy and said that I was dead to them and a danger to the kids, and I was no longer allowed to have any contact. And now they trust me. You know, they call me. And the relationships that I have with my family of origin that I so proverbially drug through the mud and completely, you know, crushed them in so many ways. You know, I have a living amend now, you know, where I'm not part of the problem. And I don't bring my stuff to them so much. I don't want to be a burden. I want to be support. I want to be there. I want to be of service. I don't want to be a drag. Like, now they want me to give them, you know, what's going on with me, and I refrain. And my brother and I are extremely close, and like I said, the kids, and even my struggling relationships I have with my mom and dad are better than they've ever been. And I just keep plugging away, guys, man. The work, you know, we always talk about the work. The work is what saves me. And you know, I've hit a lot of rough patches, and my brain is I don't like the term recovered, because it makes me feel like maybe I'm better. Because, man, my brain can flip. And the cascade of thoughts of drinking and using, whether I place myself in a position for that to happen or I don't, or something glances on the TV or anything, my brain will run, but I don't act. It gets a little bit obsessive sometimes, where I can't break that thought process, but I know what to do. I've got these steps, and I work the steps around what's going on, and I call my sponsor, and I go to extra meetings, and I sit down with my group, you know, and that's what gets me through. And, you know, a lot of the old-timers, they talk about, they never think about it anymore. And I can't relate and identify to that. I'm nowhere near that. And again, maybe that's God's way to keep me on my toes. You know, where I don't start thinking, I got this. Because I know I don't got this. I got today, you know? And I, you know, there have been some rough times with my wife and I, and you know how, like, it used to be, like, you don't know what you got until it's gone. Well, thank God I didn't give her away, and I figured out what I got without doing that. And I am so grateful for her and for my family. And my God, my friends, it makes me cry a lot. all the time that I've spent at the Salvation Army and the service work, this group that we have now is something that I truly believe will propel all of us together, like, all the way, one day at a time. It's something that really I've never seen before. Out of all the different connections I've got and all the different areas of recovery, I've never seen something like what we've got. And it takes work to keep it. And we all are in. And we all take it seriously. And that's why it's worked. And so, you know, from here on out, I commit every single morning when I wake up and I do my exact same prayers that I do. It's like word for word. I'm such a creature of habit. I got to sit in the same seat. I got to I got to have the same routine. You know, the gym at the same times, the same deal. That's what kind of gives me some serenity. I pray for the commitment, for the willingness to never stop. Because if I stop, I am so screwed. And if I am going to die, there is not another recovery in me. There is no way I can step back. And I know that so full in my head, you know, every cell of my body, that if I use, it's over. It's not another chance. It's not rolling the dice. It's a done deal. And so I'm glad I know that. But knowledge of that alone avails me zip. I gotta keep working it, and I take it seriously. I don't want to die. I want my life to keep changing and getting better, sometimes worse. But for the most part, man, this has been a ride, an adventure, a challenge. And I'm not going to give up. Not today. Thanks for letting me share.